Vina Quint, Reel 4. Yes, you were telling me about the, you know, going back to the street and seeing the label, which indicated it was a Jewish area.
Jewish area.
Yes.
And a cousin of mine had told me that he remembers hearing his father and my father. This is what he told me. I don't remember hearing this. That they buried candlesticks and some other things in the backyard. I had no desire to go over there to look. I just looked at the backyard. But I wonder if anything would ever been under there. I was not going to start that. And I imagine that other people heard these stories and they would have dug up quickly. But there was a backyard there. It was like a courtyard. And then we went around the corner where there was a big square called Renick Trabunowski. And that's apparently where people used to congregate in their horse and carriages over there. And it still looks like one of those squares. So we saw that.
Yes. Have you ever thought of asking for compensation now that you know who you were and what the situation was?
Yes. In 1981, when I decided to finally brace myself to all this, I went to a lawyer, and I had missed the mark. There was a certain time period. And he said, why didn't you do it before? You're the only survivor of the family. You had forced labor, and you had no education. But the time had passed. And my adopted parents didn't want to because they thought that I'd have to go into a court and testify and go through the story, and they just didn't want to know about it. As a matter of fact, there's to such an extent that they didn't want to know that I have an Aunt Ruthie, who's my adopted mother's, I say that only to differentiate, but normally she's just my mother. But my Aunt Ruthie a few years asked me if I ever keep in touch with the Polish Christian people who hid me. And I said, what Polish people hid me? She says, well, you know, the ones who saved your life. And I said, I wasn't hidden. She said, well, that's the way all children who survived. And in her mind, is if you were a child in Poland, nobody in a concentration camp would have survived as a child. So in her mind, she never asked me. She just assumed that. So I don't know how many other assumptions were there, but there were no Christian people who saved me. I was sent into the camps. Other children, of course, were.
When you started talking about your experiences, was that important for you to actually tell people, your husband, for instance, and children?
Oh, that's a good question, because when I first met my husband, since he came from a religious home, there apparently is some sort of law that if a girl was a hostage and she was kept, that... and he's a Kohen, which is... A Kohen is a priest. We have priests and Levites and general people. It's a category. It's not really mean anything except it's how you called up to the Torah in Jewish religion. And a Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorced woman or a child who has been violated or molested. And they sort of, they didn't know where I was and what could have happened to me. And so they asked rabbis, and they said that this is a different case. It's not a hostage that's taken that way. It's very different, and there was no problem. But he did bring that up, and it turned out to be no problem. I didn't tell my children for a long time because they had grandparents, and they were perfectly acceptable. So as it went on, I could make little hints, but very, very little, very little. When my adopted father died in 1972. I had another one of these very traumatic experiences that was more traumatic than in the camp because I was his only daughter. He loved me very much. I loved him. He was very good to me. Our relationship was the same as any child and father. And I was already a grown woman with four children, four little children, and I used to come in. He had cancer, and I used to come in every week from the country to take him for chemotherapy. And when he died, I was the one to arrange the funeral and all everything that had to be done. And in Jewish tradition, when somebody dies, the rabbi tears the clothes as a symbol of mourning. And this rabbi was not a very smart man. And he tore from the wife of the deceased, my mother, and his sister and brother, and then that was finished. So everybody said, you forgot Rina, the daughter. And the rabbi said, but she's really not his daughter. So according to tradition, according to law, she doesn't have to have this. And everybody was very upset because she is his daughter. If she's not his biological, he accepted her and she was officially adopted. And there was another rabbi in the room who was a little smarter, a little bit more willing to think, maybe. And he said, in Jewish religion, it also said if somebody is a rabbi or a teacher or someone who takes care, you mourn for him also. So even whether you give it a title or a father or a guardian, by all means do it. And I had the chance of sitting Shiva, which is the morning of Nat. So, but to think all these years, I mean, I wasn't thinking about the Holocaust and I wasn't thinking about my relationship. I mean, I was his daughter. And I was mourning the death of this man, and all of a sudden say, hey, wait a second, you're not the same as it is. So things like that happen. And things like that happen very often, and you don't want to think about it, and you think you're perfectly normal and like everybody else. And then you go to a doctor, and the doctor says, tell me your medical history. Anybody in your family have heart history? I don't know. Anybody in your family die of cancer or breast cancer? I don't know. Anybody in your family have diabetes? I don't. What do you mean you don't know? You look like a woman who should know certain things. I don't know. And you'd like to leave it at that, and you realize you can't, and you finally have to say, listen, I have no history, because all these people were killed before they ever had a chance to possibly get these kind of diseases. So things like that happen very, very often. And you have to explain it. As far as my children, the first time my son was, the same year, 1981, I guess it was, my son was in the eighth grade, and the teacher asked, there's a certain day which is commemorated of Holocaust Day, and the teacher asked if anybody had any relatives or friends or neighbors who could speak about their war experiences or who are Holocaust survivors. And my son raised his hand, and he said, yes, his mother. And she says, no, I mean somebody who actually went through the Holocaust. And my son, yes, my mother. And my husband was the chairman of the Board of Education, so he knew the teachers very well. And this teacher didn't understand what to make of my son, because my son was a good student, and here he was telling a lie or telling something that... And she called me that evening, and she said, I have to ask you something, because David said something very funny today. And I asked for a Holocaust survivor, and he said, you were one. And I said, I am one. And he said, well, nobody in school knew about it, and nobody talked about it. And I said, well, we didn't talk about it also, but the children are aware of it, even though we don't go into details about it. And she asked me to come to speak to the school. And I agreed. I don't know why I agreed, but I agreed. And it was the first time that I publicly spoke. It was very difficult, very difficult. It's much easier for me to talk about it now. I had to stop several times to catch my breath because I didn't want to cry. Just like today, you know, if you don't want to, still your eyes well up. And my mother was sitting in the audience. And the part that I found hardest was talking about when I came to the United States. Somehow or other, that always makes me. The camp situation is the camp situation, the parts. And I must tell you that even when I went to Poland, I go with this March of the Living, because they ask, there's a group, they're like maybe 5,000 students, about 17, 18 year olds, either the last year of high school, they go back they called the March of the Living because it was the march from Auschwitz to Birkenau. They marched from Auschwitz to Birkenau on this Holocaust Day. And we go to the different camps in the different cities. And when I came out of Majdanek, which is a very difficult camp to go into because you see bins and bins of shoes and you can still smell the shoes, and you go through what were the gas chambers and you see the crematoria, and I had such a, I'm not going to cry, I'm not going to cry, and I didn't, and I held on closely to my husband, but the two of us managed to go silently and just see everything and read everything. And then we came out without having cried, And in the field, we saw youngsters with Israeli flags, Jewish flags, waving them and singing. And I burst out crying at that point because I said, Hitler thought he was going to wipe us out. He didn't think any Jew would ever walk there. But look, here is our youth, and they carry these flags, and they're proud to Jews, and Hitler, you didn't win, we're here. And thank God we have an Israel now, and we have a place. And if Israel had just been born a few years before, if Jews had a place to run away to, it would have made such a huge difference. If you just think of just 10 small years, 1938 before the war, and finally was born in 1948, what a difference it would have made to the survivors, and what a difference it would have made for the victims who possibly could have survived. Unfortunately, it wasn't there. That's why I feel so very strongly about making sure that Israel is safe and is free and is a refuge for anybody who needs it.
Did you find when you started talking about your experience that it made a difference to you, that it was important to actually share that experience with other people, and the people you loved in particular?
My children really didn't want to hear about it so much. My grandchildren are more interested than my children. Maybe it was hard for them to ask, or maybe it was hard for me to tell them, and you know, we were so close. But I feel very strongly now that if any of us were asked to do anything for the victims, I'm sure each and every person that would be asked that question would say, just tell us, what can we do? And the answer is nothing. What can you do? You can't bring them back to life. You can't have given them food the last days. You can't have given them, taken away the fear. You couldn't have done anything like that. You don't have that choice. But the one thing that people kept on saying is that nobody will believe it. And right now there are people who dare keep on saying it didn't happen and the Jews are just making it up. So I think the one thing that we can do and we must do and we should do is to remember them. And if somebody reads something in a book, it doesn't have the same kind of meaning as if somebody tells them. And as you have said, the survivors are dying out. I'm one of the younger ones, and I'm not so young either. So I sort of feel if I tell it to you, you in turn will say, you know, I heard it from somebody who actually was there. And then they will tell it to somebody else. And then it won't just be history. Eventually it'll be history, but right now we still have that possibility of telling it, and I think we must. So I think it does make me feel good to do it, although it's not easy. It's not an easy thing for me to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, as much as I say I'm not going to cry, the inside of your stomach gets so wound up.
I was wondering also, if you don't mind me asking you this, Rena, you sort of implied earlier on that you didn't want to talk about it. Am I right in thinking this? Because you wanted to be like everyone else. Is there any sort of sense of shame that attaches to this at all?
There may be for some survivors. I mean, I have read in books of how people would, let's say they were capos, where they were made in charge. And people who are made in charge, once you have authority, you can do things that maybe you're not. Other people found that maybe they escaped, but because they escaped, somebody else was taken in their turn and killed. I personally, as a child, don't know that I had anything to be. I don't know that I could have done anything. I just don't know that I was smart enough or in a position to do anything. So I don't really have any guilt feelings for that. I just don't understand why I survived and the other people didn't survive. But I don't think I'm ashamed of it.
Was it that you felt very different then from other people? That you had
this
reluctance?
I was ashamed of being adopted. Not as a Holocaust survivor, but just as a child who was adopted. Because I didn't have any siblings. And I was ashamed of that if somebody would say, are you an only child? And I would say, yes, I'm an only child, knowing that I really wasn't telling the truth, knowing that I could have said I had two brothers, and they died. And, you know, some people sort of say they had a car accident or they were killed in the war, fighting, you know, as soldiers, or I would just say, yes, I'm an only child. So I was ashamed of that kind of thing. And now I realize I still don't call my mother mom or mommy. I talk about my mother, but I cannot to her face say that. Actually, it got easier once she became a grandma, because then you can say grandma. But otherwise, that was difficult, yes. Feeling different. But I don't know that it was really shame of what I did.
I'm not implying that you should. Please don't
think
that.
No.
But it's just that, you know, one wonders if, from what you had said before, what the reason was. And you have explained that so very well.
I think I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to be liked. I wanted to be like everybody else. And didn't want to be different. I don't know that I thought about it very much.
Do you think
I did have a good teenage years, growing up years. I mean, I was okay in school, and I was popular, and my parents had enough money to give me roller skates and send me to camp and go to the movies and have a sweet 16 and do all those things. And even today, I have a lot of friends. I really, I guess I cultivate friends. And many of my friends have taken me as their little sister or their big sister. And it may just, you know, be words, but I accept it as that.
You've obviously, this might seem a sort of an insensitive question, because you've obviously lost so much because of the war and what happened to you. And, you know, your childhood really was so very different, wasn't it? Your young childhood before these more golden teenage years, as it were. But would you think, looking back, that perhaps, despite all that you lost, that you might have gained anything at all from that experience? Do you think it gave you anything?
Well, I have no way of comparing it to anything else, because this is what it was and what it is. I think life is very important. I think we have to be tolerant of everybody. I think we have to live. I think we have to love to the fullest. We do a lot. I mean, my family, we travel, we entertain, we go to theater, we do. We live life to the fullest. Maybe for those who didn't live. So everything that happens sort of is to follow. But I don't know that I would have been any different. How would I ever find that out? And not only that, but sometimes I think, in my own way, that things that are blamed on the Holocaust has done a tremendous amount of damage. It has taken 6 million people, it has taken 1.5 million children. And for many people, the trauma is immense. But I also think that sometimes normal people, so to speak, who lose a child in a war, not because they're victims, but they're soldiers fighting, or a child in a car accident, or a terrorist act. Living in Israel now, a terrorist act. I don't know that the pain is any less for them, except that you think of it as being individual, whereas this was for 6 million, and for no reason except that you were Jewish. But I very often think that my trauma is not that much more than somebody else who has a terrible thing happen to them. And just yesterday I heard about a family coming from the city of Hebron, and there was a terrorist attack, and the two parents were killed, and a one-year-old child was left wounded. Now that child is going to be brought up as an orphan, or probably get new parents, or something like that. Their life will not be the same as having parents. But it's different because it's individual incidents where this happened to so many.
And finally, Rena, you know, it's what is so interesting with your story is the various phases of identity, you know, that you took on these different identities as a young boy and all the different names with mothers. Was it important to you when you find out finally who you were, where your parents, what your father did, Was that important to you?
Very, very important. Very important to me, and apparently very important to my family. And I didn't think it was that important to them, but for me, it was a verification that what I said and what I believed was true and that I didn't make it up. I mean, you know, I could say I was born, because everybody is born. But finding that that birth certificate was very, very important, and finding my parents' marriage license. And when I came back, my oldest daughter called me up 4 times within a span of maybe a few minutes. She called up, first of all, to say that she looked up the date, and I was born on a Wednesday, and all my 4 children were born on a Wednesday, so now I belong to the family. And then she said, she gave me, I was born before the holiday of Hanukkah. And then she said that she looked at, my parents were only 26 years old. They were young people. And she never thought of them as young people. And I never thought of them as young people. Because when you think of Holocaust survivors, you think of these people just drooping and being in rags like that. And 26 is so very, very young. And then she called me back to say, now I can finally have my horoscope. Because before that, I didn't really know what my birthday is. But I never changed my birthday officially, because it would just be too much to explain. Because really, my whole living life, because the life in the war was not a real life. So since the time I came to the United States, school records and college records and marriage certificates and birth certificates of my children all have the date that I had been given in Sweden. So that is the date that I continue on. So it was very important to find, to prove myself, I guess. And who do I have to prove this to but myself? But it still is. But I haven't finished. I mean, as I told you, I get very discouraged looking. And then something happens. About a month ago, I went to a place called The Joint, and I found a list of Sweden with my name and with 2 other people's names. I met somebody yesterday here in England, and I met somebody from North Carolina. She found her name on the same list. And this was the second group of children who were sent to Sweden. So it's another verification, and we just found this now. I would love to find some pictures in the Imperial War Museum. And I'm hoping I'll recognize myself. It's a long time ago.
You live in Israel now. Yes, what made you move to Israel from the United States? Was it in any way connected with the Holocaust, do you think?
I don't think so. Now that I live there, I sort of feel I should have always been there, because I was supposed to have been brought there with the children from Sweden. But I think we brought up our children as Zionists. And we used to go every summer to visit Israel, and we always found that this was the Jewish state, and it was the only country where the Jews were the majority rather than minority. Although I must tell you, where we lived in Brooklyn, in New York, we had a perfectly good life, and we were able to live as Jews with no problem at all. And my children felt that they were the majority, because most of their friends in the neighborhood where we lived in was a Jewish neighborhood. But every time we went to Israel, we kept on saying, someday we're going to move there. And then our oldest daughter married an American. She met an American, and they were married in Israel, and they decided they're going to study and live in Israel. And then our other children, they kept on saying, when they're in that position, they're going to go. And every time we went, we looked for an apartment. And one day, my mother called saying that she had just gone to a place, and they had a beautiful apartment, and the man was remarrying because he had lost his wife, so he was leaving this big apartment. It would be just exactly what we wanted. Before I knew it, my husband bought the apartment on the phone, and we went to see it and to sign all the legal papers. And now that we had an apartment, and all the children kept on saying, we want to go, we decided. It just sort of happened spontaneously, but we had always talked about it. We always felt, someday. It happened faster, I think, than we had planned on. But my husband decided at that point that we ought to go when we're young enough to be helpful in Israel, to volunteer to do things. And thank God he was a successful lawyer, and he was able to retire early. And we did come to Israel. And our life has taken a completely different turn. He has started writing books. He has started lecturing. He teaches many different classes as a volunteer. and he works with older men who are lawyers and doctors and businessmen, but who had never had the chance before retirement to sit and study from the original sources, from the original Bible and the Talmud. And so he's enjoying that immensely, and I became a guide in Yad Vashem, which is connected to the Holocaust, with the Tower of David Museum. We have a beautiful Supreme Court, and I just take people all around, mostly in Jerusalem, but I'm also involved with many different charitable organizations, and when people come to visit these organizations, then I'm sort of liaison traveling around with them. And I love it. I love it, and it gives us a chance to meet many people and to talk to different, both Jews and non-Jews, Christians and Muslims even. I work in the museum. We have a big Muslim section, so it gives us a chance to meet all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And it also gives me a chance in Yad Vashem to talk about what happened and show the exhibit, not through my own personal life, but through the pictures of me.
You knew we're starting a Holocaust department in this museum. I wonder if you have any thoughts on how one can depict something like the Holocaust in a museum.
There are many different ways, and if you think of the different museums that are around, each museum has its own character or its own characteristics. Yad Vashem is a historical depiction of what happened to the Jewish people between 1933 to 1945. Many of the pictures we used were taken by the Nazis themselves. Most of them, I would imagine 90%. And they talk from the Jewish point of view of what happened to them. They don't talk as much about the gypsies or the homosexuals or Jehovah's Witnesses. This is their approach. In a place called Lohamei HaGetto'ot, which is up north, they talk pre-war Europe also. They talk about what life was like, the youth groups, the leadership, the sports kinds of things, and they want to show you a little bit of a contrast there. In Washington, the Holocaust Museum brings in many of the characteristics from the liberators, from the American liberators' point of view. And in Los Angeles, which is a Hollywood kind of a thing, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is called the Museum of Tolerance, shows you how genocide and a Holocaust can happen from different points of view, but then they start with different genocides and different intolerance and bigotry and ending up with the uniqueness of the Jewish Holocaust, because the Holocaust was not just a genocide. I mean, Hitler wanted to wipe out every Jew in every corner, and it was different because during the Inquisition, if they didn't want Jews, if a Jew would be willing to convert to Christianity, they had a chance of survive. Or if there would be a war where they wanted your property, if a Jew would be willing to give up his property, they could survive. In Nazi Germany, no matter what you would have done, if you had Jewish blood in you, you were doomed to die. It amazes me that it took so many years for Britain to build this Holocaust Museum, because they have so much information. The reason I came here is because I was told that so much was burned by the Germans as they realized that the war was almost over. So a lot of information has been destroyed. But the British took it at liberation, and much of the BBC works and other photos apparently have not been shown to the public. So I'm delighted that it's going to come out. And I know that your museum is a war museum, but it was a general war museum, so thank God that there's a special thing, because I think in the United States also, World War II and the Holocaust were synonymous. But there is a difference between the war, the territorial expansion, and the war against the Jews. And so I think that this museum will probably focus on that. And I imagine Bergen-Belsen, which was liberated by the British, you have more information than anybody in the world.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Rina, for coming along today and telling me about your war and post-war experiences. It really has been very interesting. Thank you. And good luck with your researches.
Thank you very much.